This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Republican State Representative Eric Nesbitt is seeking re-election to the 66th District, which includes all of Van Buren County and Northwest Kalamazoo County. But first, we hear from an evolutionary evangelist. Reverend Michael Dowd says there doesn't have to be a divide between science and religion. He will speak tomorrow night at Portage United Church of Christ. His presentation is titled, "The Future is Calling Us to Greatness, Climate as the Great Reckoning." Dowd spoke via Skype with WMUK's Andy Robbins.
You call yourself an itinerant evolutionary evangelist. What exactly do you mean by that?
Sure. I ended up pastoring three churches, three United Church of Christ congregations over the course of about a decade, from the mid-'80s to the mid-'90s. And then I did environmental sustainability and community organizing work for about 5 years. And then the last 12 years, Connie and I have traveled all over North America. We've spoken to close to 2,000, in fact, probably more than 2,000 groups at this point, of all different kinds. I mean, literally from evangelicals to atheists and everything in between. And what we focus on is the sacred side of science. We focus on sharing an ecological and evolutionary worldview, but focusing specifically on the practical and inspiring side of that. So my great mentor was Thomas Berry, and this whole universe story, what's now being called big history, but it's the epic of evolution is the way Edward O. Wilson spoke about it. But it's the history of everyone and everything, physical evolution, biological evolution, and cultural evolution as our first and only globally produced evidence-based creation story. And it gives us a far more reality-based understanding of the significance, the evolutionary significance of religion and how to move into a healthy future, how to move forward in a healthy way.
The whole topic of evolution is perhaps the poster child for conflict between science and religion. Got kind of a taste of that recently with some reaction to the reboot of the Cosmos TV series with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Can that gap be bridged between those who believe in the literal truth of the Bible or other foundational texts that try to explain how the world came to be and what science thinks actually happened?
No, I don't think it can be reconciled. Biblical literalism disses God. It basically says that God spoke all the cool, important stuff 2,000 years ago. And I don't think that you can possibly slander God more powerfully than that. I lift up evidential revelation that God has been speaking. And when I use the word God, I'm meaning nothing less than a sacred name of reality, that reality has been speaking to us very clearly for 400 or 500 years through all forms of evidence. So I see facts as God's native tongue. I see evidence as modern day scripture. And so God has been speaking very clearly that evolution is a fact, that global warming, climate change is a fact. Yes, there have been profound shifts in climate over the millions and even billions of years, but we now know beyond any shadow of a doubt. I mean, 99% now of scientists, climate scientists, agree that we, you know, 97% from between 2001 and 2012, it was 97% of climate scientists. But since then, it's now up to 99% of climate scientists agree that climate change is real, that humans are the main cause, and that we must take immediate action to avoid condemning our children and grandchildren to a literal hell and high water. So no, I don't think biblical fundamentalism, biblical literalism can be squared with or reconciled to, but I think biblical literalism is trivializing God and gospel both.
But so to that extent, then, you believe that science and religion do not have to be mutually antagonistic?
Absolutely. But if it sort of depends on what you mean by science and what you mean by religion. If what you mean by science is just sort of this mechanistic reductionism, well, yeah, it's tough to square that with the inspirational traditions of the world's great religious traditions. And if what you mean by religion is just supernatural otherworldlyism, well, then, yeah, it's tough to square that with science. But if you understand science as humanity's global collective intelligence in helping us to understand the two fundamental questions that humans have always needed to address, namely what's real or how things are, and what's important or which things matter, that our best global collective intelligence on that, if you understand science as the global community of people trying to come to a clearer understanding of that, then yes, I see that science and religion can actually be in a mutually enhancing relationship.
As implied by the title of your presentation in Portage, you see climate and climate change as the Great Awakening. Why?
Well, actually, I speak about it as the Great Reckoning. The great, I think that we have been out of right relationship to reality. We've been out of right relationship to God. Part of that is because we've had a trivial, impotent notion of God. We've thought of God as only outside time and nature rather than incarnate or embodied or revealed or expressed in time and nature, as well as mystery, of course. And so when we no longer have a trivial notion of God, then it becomes clear. We've been out of right relationship to God. We've been out of right relationship to reality. And we're now about to experience the consequences. And that's why I say climate change is the great reckoning, where humanity has been out of right relationship to reality or God, and where we're now about to experience the consequences. And it's not because some supernatural being up there, out there, is pissed off at us and going to punish us. It's because we've been out of right relationship to reality, and there are costs, there are consequences of that. I do also believe that climate change will eventually be seen as the great homecoming. It's kind of like humanity is the prodigal species, that we've squandered our inheritance, that we're waking up in the pig pen, as it were. We're waking up to our predicament, and hopefully we're coming home to reality, to God, to the way things really, really are. And people sometimes say, well, how do you speak to fundamentalists and people who are in denial of climate change? And I say, I don't have to convert them. Their kids and grandkids are already starting to convert them, because they're basically saying, we have to live in this world. And your theology, if it's all about, you know, that we don't have to take responsibility for the world 100 years from now because Jesus is coming back, we see that as irresponsible. And so it's amazing how young people are impacting their parents and grandparents on exactly that issue.
You call yourself a climate hawk. What do you mean by that?
Climate hawk was a term I think coined at first by David Roberts, who did one of the most powerful TED Talks on climate I've ever seen. It's called Climate Change is Simple. David Roberts, he writes for Grist. And the remix is where they add music. So if you just put Climate Change is Simple remix, you'll get there. I can't recommend it too highly. I mean, Connie and I had our climate change come to Jesus moment watching that just under 2 years ago. But he coined the term climate hawk, and also climate patriot are two terms that are used, which basically for me means I am wholeheartedly, fully supportive of aggressive climate action, that we need to tax carbon. We need to put a fair price on carbon pollution and do so as soon as possible. I mean, the idea that we still allow for the free or subsidized polluting of the commons is collective insanity. I mean, no corporation should be able to get wealthy by, toxifying the air, water, soil, or life upon which we all depend. And no corporation should get wealthy at the expense of future generations. It's just crazy. So I'm for aggressive action, putting a fair price on carbon pollution or taxing carbon or however you want to talk about it. I mean, my hero on this point is a Republican, Bob Inglis from South Carolina. He said it more succinctly than anybody I've ever heard. He said, this is a direct quote. He says, I favor a conservative approach that marshals the power of the market and doesn't increase the size of government. Here it is in a nutshell. Put all the costs in all the fuels and eliminate all the subsidies, and then watch the free enterprise system solve the climate and energy problem. And I just think he nails it. It's just exactly what we need to do. So I'm a climate hawk, as somebody who's enthusiastically in favor of that kind of thing.
To return to the subject of your views on science and religion, I gather from what I've read that your own personal journey has been, shall we say, interesting. Your Wikipedia entry, for example, says that you were originally a young Earth creationist, meaning you thought that you were among those who thought that the Earth has only existed for a few thousand rather than a few billion years.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I grew up Roman Catholic, but I had a born-again experience, a very powerful transformative experience in my I was 20 in Berlin, Germany. And I was discipled in a fundamentalist Pentecostal Assemblies of God context that was very anti-evolution. I thought that the end of the world was going to happen, that we'd never see the year 2000. This was back in 1979. And I, you know, read the Bible straight through twice like a book. And then another time I read it through, you know, about five chapters a day for a year, and was very anti-science. And so, yeah, I've had a sort of a conversion, I guess you could say, my road to Damascus experience, where I, since 1984 at Evangel College, actually affiliated with the Assemblies of God, that's where I accepted evolution because they teach evolution there. They just teach it in a God-honoring way. And then in 1988, I was introduced to Father Thomas Beria, a Catholic monk who, a teacher, he called himself a geologian, not a theologian, but a geologian. And he was sort of the next step after Teilhard de Chardin. And he became a mentor of mine in 1988. And so I essentially have been a Christian naturalist ever since. I don't have any supernatural or otherworldly beliefs. For me, I interpret all of the aspects of my Christian faith as undeniably real in a this world way, and am deeply inspired by that. But one of the things I'm really grateful for is that I've spoken to 2,000 groups over the last 12 years. And I think one of the reasons why my book was endorsed, my book, Thank God for Evolution, was endorsed by six Nobel Prize winning scientists, as well as by theologians and priests and rabbis and religious leaders, is because it gives voice not just to my ideas or Connie's and my ideas. It gives voice to this whole movement that I've begun calling the Evidential Reformation, Religion 3.0. It's you know, Religion 1.0 is the authority of the elders. Religion 2.0 is the authority of Scripture. Religion 3.0 is the authority of evidence, global collective intelligence. And so I can do the same exact program in virtually any setting, religious of all different kinds or secular. And I know from experience, because we used to hand out feedback forms, that, you know, something like 90% of the people who come to my programs are gonna love it, because we focus on the inspiring side of what's being revealed by God, by reality, evidentially. You could say the sacred side of science.
You did an interview recently with one of my public radio colleagues talking about these issues. And in the story that that station had on it, it pointed out that at least one member of the faculty of Evangel College claims your theology is not Christian.
Well, you know, Evangel College, it's interesting. They don't know quite what to do with me because, I graduated with, you know, like practically a 4.0 average. I think I got 1B. I'm sure I'm the only alum that has ever had a Nobel Prize winning scientist endorse their book, much less six of them. So they want to be proud of me. And yet they also, my theology is quite a bit more liberal than most of the, professors and students at Evangel College. I will say this, that my, I don't want to overstate, I said earlier that people across the religious and philosophical and theological spectrum are, embracing this message, but I don't want to overstate the case there, because that doesn't include everybody. For example, Al Mohler, the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, who's one of the go-to people in the media when they want a fundamentalist voice on something, he was asked to comment on a sermon that he had listened to of mine, and he said, he gave me my favorite criticism of all time. He said, "Michael Dowd gives even heresy a bad name." So I don't want to overstate that everybody thinks that my message is wonderful.
In the years that you've been traveling, speaking about these things, have you detected a surge in your direction, or is it going to be an ongoing conversation with those who don't accept what you say?
I think both. I've certainly seen over the last 12 years of traveling North America with Connie, my wife, who's a science writer, I've certainly seen, especially among young people, just a hunger for sort of interpreting what science is giving us in ways that are soul nourishing, that in ways that are inspiring, in ways that that help us live more integrous lives and have greater joy and be of service to our communities and to the future. So yes, I certainly have seen that. But again, I don't want to overstate. There's still certainly resistance to science. I mean, I read a book a couple of years ago that just angered me like nothing I've read in a long time. It was called "Fool Me Twice: Fighting the Assault on Science in America." It was by Sean Lawrence Otto. And books like that, and books like that really show how it is that science is being dissed by some of the postmodernists, as well as some of the religious right and the political right, I found myself feeling kind of like Muslims must feel when the Quran is dissed. You know, this rage, this righteous rage that for me, evidence is sacred. Evidence is holy. Facts are God's native tongue. And I've committed my life to helping to promote the inspiring side of an ecological evolutionary worldview. And that's what I'll be doing in Portage at the UCC Church.
Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great. Thank you, Andy.
The Reverend Michael Dowd spoke via Skype with WMUK's Andy Robbins. Dowd will speak tomorrow night at Portage United Church of Christ. Links with more information can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. State Representative Eric Nesbitt is seeking a third term in the Michigan House. The Republican represents all of Van Buren County, as well as Northwest Kalamazoo County in the 66th District. Eric Nesbitt, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on again, Gordon. Always a pleasure.
Please tell our audience what you would do if you got another 2 years in the State House.
Yeah, the last 3.5 years been really working to create jobs, concentrated on ending regulatory burdens. We've eliminated nearly 2,000 rules and regulations. There's a lot more work to do with that. We've paid down $20 billion of debt. There's still $45 billion of long-term debt and liability in the state that needs to be paid down so our children and grandchildren aren't stuck with the bills of yesterday's politicians overspending and overpromising, and really need to continue to work on continuing improvements on our tax code. Those are the big issues, along with our energy issues. I chair the Energy and Technology Committee, and I think there's still a lot of opportunities to make our costs more competitive here in the state. We have to respond to the new EPA rules that are coming down from the federal level. And then after this last winter, I think there's more work to do in terms of next mile natural gas expansion and allowing more individuals in rural areas access to a lower cost natural gas.
If you were going to start with a blank slate on the state's tax system, how would you want to redesign it? In other words, and with the idea of bringing in approximately the same amount of revenue we do now, what are the things you'd like to maybe tax a little more? What are the things you'd like to dial back taxes?
Yeah, I'm somebody who, when you look at tax reform overall, look at fairness, efficiency in the tax system. I think we've came a long ways in terms of the business tax climate. Before, small businesses were taxed really three times between their businesses, the Michigan business tax, the surcharge, and then taxed on their individual levels. The small businesses are now taxed once at a flat individual income rate, and then corporations. Before, they had dozens and dozens of loopholes and exemptions and special credits, and now that's a 6% flat corporate income tax rate. So we moved from a bottom 5 state to a top 20 state. We've come a long ways with that.
Personal according to whose numbers there in terms
tax
of
tax foundation.
Okay.
Yep. So tax foundation has had us ranked at 47th, and we're in 7th now in terms of our competitiveness with our business tax system. There's still more work to do on personal property taxes in terms of broadband development, for example. It really punishes new technology, the current system of personal property tax. We're doing a phase out on manufacturers that the voters had a say in. And I think after you invest in having to pay taxes for years going in the future, it's a real challenge. In terms of the individual income tax, I believe we have had a flat income tax since the late 60s. There's been three different statewide ballot proposals on going to a progressive tax, which I oppose going to a progressive income tax. But I think overall, in terms of the work of getting to a flatter, fairer, more efficient tax code, we've come a long ways, but there's still some more work to do, as I said, especially in terms of dealing with the personal property tax issue.
Do you want to cut taxes further, either for personal income tax or for businesses?
I think as you look at it, the most destructive tax is the individual income tax because it taxes people in terms of their work. It would be nice to continue to see some movement on that as part of the tax reform package, but again, it's something that needs to be done in a responsible manner as we continue to move forward.
responsible manner, meaning you'd have to find the...
Well, it's one of those things where in 2011, when I came in, we were dealing with a $1.5 billion deficit. It was a structural deficit that went back for years and years throughout the last decade. And not trying to play the blame game, but it was something where we had to make real tough decisions and making sure that we brought the budget into balance. And paying down debt, investing in roads and transportation and education have all been priorities, but over the last 3.5 years, we've been able to do both the tax reform in a responsible manner in terms of making it fairer and more efficient, concentrating on job growth, and also in terms of our investments, in terms of the budget. We've put in over another $500 million into our roads and transportation to the general fund without a tax increase, and that's something where the House passed a plan earlier this year to enhance transportation, funding, get us at an additional $500 million a year into state roads, and it's done in a responsible manner. In 2011, I remember when we were passing it was a tough budget, but we had to get to a point of stopping, overspending and paying down debt. And we've moved the rainy day fund from less than $2 million, which was about how much the Lawton Public Schools had in their rainy day fund at the time, to over $500 million today. Credit ratings improving, and the job picture is improving slightly, but there's a lot more work to be done on, both in terms of the regulatory front and I'd say continued work on the tax reform front.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans, speaking with State Representative Eric Nesbitt. The Republican represents all of Van Buren County and Northwest Kalamazoo County in the 66th District. He's seeking his third term in the House. Let's get to energy. You have long been a proponent of exploring for and extracting natural gas. Of course, this leads to the debate over hydraulic fracturing or fracking. How safe is it to get natural gas that way?
Some of the areas, I led the subcommittee on natural gas in my first term as chair. It was an ad hoc committee. We produced a report. I'd encourage people to take a look at that report from the State House. You just go to www.repnesbitt.com. That's R-E-P, Nesbitt. .com, and the subcommittee's report's on there. And we wanted to examine to see, in terms of the production, in terms of midstream delivery, and also end use on natural gas. It's 40% the carbon content of oil or coal. And it's also, in terms of, you look at the commodities over the last 7 years, it's only really one of the few commodities that have really went down in price. We were paying about $14 for a million BTUs in 06, 07. Today, it's around $4 for a million BTUs. This has helped manufacturers in the state. For example, Dow Chemical said they'd never again build another chemical facility in the United States because of the price of natural gas. Over the last few years, they've invested over $10 billion in terms of expansions at some of their chemical plants around the U.S., a Michigan-based company. Used to be investing in the Middle East because of the price of natural gas there. Now they're reinvesting in the United States. The New York Times just had an article on the Midwest manufacturing renaissance because of energy prices and energy security. We want to keep clean air, clean water, and clean land. These are definitely priorities. In Michigan, we've had over 60 years of hydraulic fracturing that has happened, nearly 13,000 wells over the last 60 years. A lot of people don't know that we're 13th in natural gas production out of the states in the U.S., 18th in oil production. I remember my dad telling me in the 50s and 60s, in the back 40 on our land, there used to be actually a little oil well back there. And so looking at Michigan, we treasure our Great Lakes, we treasure our water resources, and we're considered to have some of the toughest regulatory environment through the Department of Environmental Quality nationally. Over the last 4 years since I've been on the Energy and Tech Committee, the Department of Environmental Quality has updated their rules and regulations. Hydraulic fracturing twice. New mandates are coming down saying that they have to do pre-water well testing and making sure that anything that's a cause, and that we make sure we find and go after those oil and gas companies, hard and effectively.
Yeah, however, let me stop you for just a moment, because earlier on you were talking about reducing regulations that might get in the way of economic development. So how do you balance that then with what you're talking about in terms of we treasure our Great Lakes and our natural resources here in Michigan.
Yeah, and this is something in terms of ensuring that our environment is protected. There's certain roles for regulation. I'm talking, you know, what I was talking about earlier is when you have redundancy and when you have overlap and when you have old licenses that aren't needed anymore. In terms of the industry, in terms of extraction, this is, you know, our natural resources, mineral resources are owned by all the citizens of the state. And the unique thing here in Michigan is that when you do lease sales of state land or bonus bids, this all goes to the Natural Resources Trust Fund or the State Parks Fund to protect our environment, to purchase land for permanent preservation. You see projects such as the Calhaven Trail, such as projects along Lake Michigan where land, you know, has been purchased to prevent development. Just in Van Buren County, this year we approved purchase of 400 acres of land to permanently be preserved as part of the DNR's wildlife production areas to ensure access for future generations for not just hunting and fishing, but bird watching and other things. So there's real money being created from it, but it also you need to make sure it's done safely and effectively. And that's something where even the EPA says they haven't found one case of underwater contamination, but we need to make sure that we do have the proper regulatory environment that, you know, because I don't believe that environmental protection and economic development are mutually exclusive.
Let me ask you about what has gone on with Aramark and the prison food system. There was a story just out today or yesterday in the Detroit Free Press that Aramark was supposed to be fined $98,000. The Department of Corrections didn't actually collect the money, decided to let them, as they say, address the problems themselves. What sort of lessons does this give going forward when the state is considering privatizing services?
And whenever you competitively bid a service or a product, you need to make sure you have the proper oversight and complete oversight of what's going on. And this is something where I'd say that current employees, you know, should have the same opportunity in terms of bidding for that project. And it's not just always cost. It also needs to be looked at in terms of quality. And if people, you know, if people mess up, they're not following their contract, that there has to be punishment and harm or changes made. We want to be efficiently and effectively managing the resources and the taxpayer money that we're entrusted with from the taxpayers around the state. And there's a certain level of service that those taxpayers expect for providing their hard-earned money to provide these services, whether that's in education, whether that's in roads and transportation, whether that's in other state services, such as making sure the bad guys are locked up. That does not include having maggots and food, though. And that's something where I would like to see more, you know, more being addressed on that issue. And I have talked to the appropriations chair to see, you know, what kind of not just, you know, punishments, but also changes are going to be going down. I mean, people shouldn't be, you know, free to fly how they want. These are, government services that are offered. And if it's a government contract, it needs to be followed through.
You are seeking your third term in the House. That is all that you're currently allowed under the Michigan Constitution because of the amendment approved by voters back in 1992. Do you think that Michigan has it right on term limits, or do you think that the system could stand to be changed? Would there be improvements you would like to see?
Term limits were passed So 1992. California did an interesting thing where they, because currently you're allowed to serve up to 14 years.
Six in the House, eight in the Senate.
Six in the House, eight in the Senate. And California, and I'm not usually a big fan of following California's lead on everything. However, they did what I'd consider a hybrid system where you could serve up to 12 years in any combination of office.
So it could be 12 in the House, could be 12 in the Senate, could be split between the two in any denomination.
And I know there's some that has proposed, you know, having it at 16 or 14. And you know, so currently you're at 14 years, and it's something where you see in terms of regional cohesion that all of a sudden you're done with your, you know, 6 years. You see it from some members or 4 years, that you see kind of a breakdown in terms of some regional cohesion because you're running against two other members within your area for a state Senate seat. And so I think that's something where part of the discussion's been out there. I think it's a unique opportunity to, you know, to look at, but anything would have to be passed by the voters at the end of the day. And I think part of the discussion would be, you know, a hybrid system that would allow a bit more flexibility, you know, without having folks that have been there for 40 years.
Eric Nesbitt, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
State Representative Eric Nesbitt is running for re-election in the 66th District. Republican currently represents all of Van Buren County and Northwest Kalamazoo County. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.